TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I brought us some Starfleet combat rations today. This one here, this is a little something special, cooked up just for Sisko. It's French onion soup flavor.
Oh, great. So it's Sisko's last stand, and what do we got? Combat rations. Fantastic.
Hey, Miles loves them.
You know, Miles is crazy. So.
All right, everyone. We're going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine today with episode 3, the third part of the trilogy that kicks off season 2. It's The Siege. And here is a quick rundown. With civilians evacuated, Sisko, Lee Nalis, and the station's crew prepare for the arrival of the Bajoran militia and their Vidal Sassoon salon-perfect hair. Missing from the gang are Kira and Dax, who have gone to the Bajoran moon Luna 5 to ask the local Paluku spider dogs if they can borrow an abandoned raider from the days of the occupation. They plan to crash the Chamber of Ministers and reveal evidence that the Cardassians are supplying the Circle with weapons. General Krim and his sidekick, Colonel Day, easily succumb to the crew's guerrilla tactics and hand the station back over to Sisko. But things don't turn out so rosy for the Navark. So Matthew, this part of the story, it starts off with Sisko realizing... Not that he realizes in the moment, but we are seeing that he has completely bought into the mission that Starfleet sent him on in the first place to help the Bajorans. And he's going to ignore orders from Starfleet and he's going to stay there and stand by their side when they need him most.
This is one of the things that I really like about this episode. And one of the things that we've been discussing is we've been talking about this three-part arc is the way in which it is meant to kind of mirror the beginning of the first season and where the characters were. And so for Sisko to make this decision that he is truly not only just bought into the message, but this is home for him. Like, you know, as he has that conversation, he talks about all of the different Starfleet people who have intertwined their life with the Bajorans. Mm-hmm. Like they have created a world together and a life together. And there's something incredibly beautiful about that because and this is one of the things I just truly love about Deep Space Nine is the way in which it embodies that idea of that we as a people, as a species, are made for community. We are made for relationship. And so the way in which we actually really get involved with people is by starting relationships with them, friendships with them, we romances with them, and like we create this sense of family with them, and there's something really, really nice with the way in which this episode begins, and that speech that Sisko gives, and it is kind of like a really poignant and kind of heartrending moment when you just realize how quickly in a year that these people have, you know, woven their lives. They have already begun to create this tapestry for their lives together. And this situation is trying to rend it apart. And Sisko is basically saying, No. You know, I'm not going to allow that to happen. And, you know, maybe we're bending some of the rules here for Starfleet and whatnot, but he also is aware that what is best for then the Bajoran people is also to learn the truth about what's going on and who's behind this so that what happened then to them before doesn't happen again. And so, yeah, I mean, there's just so much about this that I truly love.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he is protecting them from a small group of people who I think it's actually a line in the episode who would deliver the Bajorans back into the hands of the Cardassians.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, the people are, they think they're supporting one thing when actually the person that they're supporting is undermining their very existence and their very well-being. And that comes through very well right here.
That's one of those things to which pinpoints the historical nature of this story. How many times has this happened? You know, a people thought that they knew one thing when really it was another, you know, because they weren't willing to actually dig in further to the reality of the situation because the surface level was giving them what they wanted.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's so often the case. The surface level is all that anyone looks at, and they don't take time to examine reality and what's really happening, and bad things happen, as would be the case here. So Sisko also, you mentioned him pointing out how Starfleet crew members had become intertwined with Bajoran residents on the station and with Bajor itself, and you can't just rip that apart. And I think, you know, as someone who has lived most of my adult life outside of the culture that I grew up in, you know, my life is completely in Japan. This is my home. I couldn't imagine not being here because everything in my life is here. And right. I think that's something that can be very difficult for people from the outside looking in to understand. I still to this day, I'll have people ask me, oh, well, when are you coming home? When are you coming back? Like, well, it's been 30 years, so I actually am at home now. It could also be hard for people in the culture, in your adopted culture, to understand too, because
right,
they think, oh, you know, you don't belong here. Like, well, actually, I've been here longer than you've been alive, right? So, I think just that little bit of cultural commentary, which isn't deeply explored in the episode or anything, but it is there, and it's something that does stand out to me.
Well, and I'll say too, you know, I experience on a smaller scale that same thing, right? You know, people hear that I'm from Texas and you know, I live in the Northwest now, and they often say, oh, you know, are you going to be going back to Texas? Are you going to be going home? And it's like, well, no, this is home.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that makes Deep Space Nine interesting and is that we don't get that opportunity with a show like Voyager or with The Next Generation or, you know, even really necessarily Enterprise to understand the connections that we as people have to places. And then the people that are in those places. And so I think that is something that is done really well then in this show. And specifically, I think, you know, this whole arc has been leading to that. But this moment with Sisko at the very beginning when he's giving this speech brings that home, right? It brings that idea fully into focus. And it also, by doing that, it allows the first season to kind of be brought into clarity that's what's been happening. And when he says that, because of all the stuff that they've been through and the episodes that we got in the first season, it feels legitimate. right? Mm-hmm. And a big part of that, and this is a small part of this, but we were talking about this, you know, on the other side of the orb, but the whole Jake and Nog scene, right, mm-hmm. brings this home as well.
Yeah.
You know, we have these two characters who, you know, Nog says, have there ever been better friends between mm-hmm. any of our kind before?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And no. And part of that is the year that they've spent together and the relationship that they have been able to forge for all that they've been through. Mm-hmm. And it is like that scene. It's strange, but even talking about it, it's like it kind of gets you in the feels because there is something incredibly special then about these two characters who should not be friends. Mm-hmm. being the best of friends because they have found a way to kind of bridge their differences mm-hmm. and actually allow those differences to make them better people in mm-hmm. the end. And there's something incredibly beautiful about that. I mean, that's the this is a microcosm of Star Trek and what it's trying to get across to us in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it shows they are kids and it shows that those differences haven't solidified yet. When you're a kid, it's, you're kind of open to anything. And so they are both not locked into the view of each other's cultures that the adults have, that humans have with the Ferengi have the humans and so forth. So they're able to just come together. And you see that in the real world all the time where people from different backgrounds and cultures play together as kids because of yes. where they're living and they get along just fine. So there's something about our species and our society where we, as we get older, it's easy to get locked into certain views and you just put up a wall and you have these preconceived notions of other people that just block you from interacting with them at all. But it's not natural for us, actually. It's something that happens because of culture and society. And with Jake and Nog, it's great that we have these two young people on the station who were from two cultures that have already been set up in Star Trek to be enemies so that we can see how that gap can be bridged at an early age.
Well, and two, I mean, I think of this moment and how pivotal it is for the story of Nog, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is really, I think, one of our first inklings that there is something about this character to which his storyline is going to be important. It's going to continue, and it's going to be really, really interesting to watch. And it may surprise us in the places that he's going to go. You know, mm-hmm. oh, the places you will go. Nog is going to go some really interesting places. And you know, on top of that, one of the other things that you had brought up was just the way in which we talked about the idea of there being that the show is really about family mm-hmm. and it's about families because it's about the place they live in a way that is very different than any of our other Star Trek series and the way in which then the O'Briens are having to face this situation and Keiko's reaction, you know, Keiko can kind of sometimes get a bad rap, but I find her reaction to be so incredibly real and mm-hmm. realistic. And because what does she care about? They have a very young daughter, and what she wants more than anything is for her and her husband to be safe.
Yeah.
She does not want to lose the father of her child and her husband. And so that interaction between them and her having to accept that he's going to do this is just incredibly real. And it makes it, I think the episode is all the better for these little moments where we're actually focusing on the reality of what it would be like to live through this situation, mm-hmm. that we don't discount any of that. It's good writing. And it makes Deep Space Nine feel like a place that you could imagine actually living. That's the kind of thing, you know, most of Star Trek feels like a thing where it's like, wouldn't it be kind of cool to do that? But like Deep Space Nine actually feels like a place that you could actually live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Keiko's reaction is completely understandable because, like you said, they have a young child. She doesn't want to lose the father, doesn't want to lose her husband. And she's concerned about her future and Molly's future. And I think it mirrors real life in many ways. There are things that happen in the world that are earth-shattering, that change the course of history, that are huge, and people need to be involved and need to not allow a small number of people to guide our entire civilization in one direction or the other, but they're more focused on their daily lives instead, which is understandable. That's human nature. And you see that here in how some people react, and particularly in dialogue here with Keiko, where Miles tells her, we can't just let the Cardis have the wormhole. And she says, they can have the whole gamma quadrant for all I care.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very real reaction. It's a very real, like, well, this doesn't really concern me. Like, I can just go about my life and it doesn't really matter, when actually it will have a huge impact her and Molly if the Cardassians were to come back and the Federation's driven away, and then the Cardassians control this critical asset in the wormhole that bridges the Alpha Quadrant, the Delta Quadrant. And I thought that I like the moment in the episode. I like the writing because it really does shine a light on the reality of how people typically react in the face of world-changing events. And because they're so concerned with their daily lives, they allow very bad things to happen. And Miles, being someone who fought in the war, understands what's at stake. And he doesn't want to leave Molly. He doesn't want to leave Keiko, but he also can see the bigger picture of what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, her attitude is basically, I don't give a flying frack about all this stuff if we put it in Battlestar Galactica parlance. But, you know, the beauty of that is that it makes sense in every way that she would feel like this. And I think that's one of the things that this arc really does, is that it taps into those real human emotions for the characters that we all completely get, because they're the ways in which we would react to those situations. In fact, just a quick moment that I think also is a part of this is that moment right between Jake and Sisko, his father, when he doesn't want to leave, right? But then there's that moment when he returns and they have that hug, and there's something incredibly interesting that even, you know, the beginning of the second season, these two actors have such a rapport with one another that you completely buy that Jake is the son of Sisko, because it feels like Sarak is the son, right? Like, like Sarak and Avery are father and son. You don't even question that's not the case. And there's something that's amazing, right?
And they did develop that relationship in reality. Yeah, and
absolutely.
It's interesting that Sarak Lofton and the role of Jake, the idea for Avery Brooks as Benjamin Sisko of the importance of a black man as a father to his children, is one thing that attracted him to the role. But it opens up something in Avery Brooks, who's a very eccentric man, a very eccentric actor.
Yes.
But there's something when he's with Sarak, when Benjamin and Jake are together, it's like a switch is flipped in Avery Brooks.
I agree.
You can tell that this means something important to him, and he actually kind of shifts into a different mode than he's normally in with these storylines.
Yeah, I agree.
While we're talking about characters, let's go ahead and talk about Spider-Dog, as I've put it on the rundown
Spider-Dog, here. Spider-Dog does whatever a Spider-Dog does.
I'm just picturing, so spiders spin webs, dogs like to pee on fire hydrants and trees and things, so I'm picturing a combination here.
It's, it's special, man. It's special.
So this is one of the weirdest transitions, I guess, we've ever had between topics, but
it is.
But what we're actually transitioning to in terms of characters are Dax and Kira in this mission they go on to this moon where this spider dog creature, it's actually a spider creature, but I think it's Dax who says, is that a dog or a spider?
Yeah.
And then we find out that actually, apparently, they're kind of tasty. Kira says they used to eat them.
Yeah.
But here's another case where the writers find a way to pair two characters together, send them off on a mission. And it's one that I think makes a lot of sense because of Jadzia's, her wisdom of having lived many lifetimes and her ability to, I would say that wisdom that she has allows her to kind of balance Kira's emotions because Kira's in this situation where it's a very, we've seen her evolve drastically from where she was early in the first season, but now when she's in a situation where she can see her people being handed back over to the Cardassians, you know, her temper and her drive comes out a lot. And I think that Jadzia is a good character to go with her. We saw Miles go with her at the beginning of the trilogy to rescue Lee Nalis. I don't think that would work here. He would not be the right person to be with her in this situation.
Yeah,
Jadzia is.
No, I think you make a great point there. And I think one of the things that also makes this fun, right, is that you have Jadzia who, even though she has all this experience and everything, you know, she's kind of a hoity-toity Starfleet person, you know, who's so used to having things so easy. And then, you know, Kira's on the other side. It's a completely different situation, right? She's used to living in the worst of situations and making the best of it. And so I also think that that whole dynamic makes this a lot of fun as well. And, you know, like you said, they begin to just kind of experiment with characters and putting them together and seeing what happens. And I think these two are a lot of fun. And it creates a great female relationship between the two where, you know, they can talk about all sorts of things together. You know, they talk about work, they talk about life, they talk about relationships, they talk about, you know, everything. And in that, there's a real reality then to their relationship. And so I that's just one of the things I just absolutely love. And you know, they're funny together. They're, they're just funny together.
Yeah.
And part of that I think is I noticed in this episode, it felt like Terry Farrell had found just a real comfort level with
it's
her
very
character.
Noticeable. Yeah.
And that really helps, this whole situation as well.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And this situation also, I feel like the idea of they go to this moon, they find this ship that's been sitting up there for maybe 10 years, they get it working, and then they fly, you've got a little bit of a battle. It's a way of injecting some action into Star Trek. And I think in a way that the fans at the time felt that Deep Space Nine lacked some of that. And also, not only do they inject it here, but some of there's a level of action in this episode, both with Jadzia and Kira in the ship, as well as the firefights that happen on the station, that is elevated above what we've seen in The Next Generation pretty much at any point, right? Like they're starting to push the envelope of action in Star Trek a little bit.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I agree.
But it still, I think, makes sense for the story. Whereas on Warp 5, we were talking about the firefight with the Zindi reptilians and insectoids and like how long that went on
when
some of the rest of the story was kind of shortchanged because they used time for that action instead of for the character. But you don't feel that in here. Like, I think it all works quite well to give us a little bit more excitement while serving the story at the same time.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. I think that the action always serves the characters here, and not the other way around. And I think that would make it's what makes the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I just mentioned the firefights, so I guess it's a good time to talk about the Bajoran militia a little bit. And the one thing that's always kind of bugged me about this story in general, the whole Circle trilogy and the heavy focus on the Bajoran militia, is that I don't feel like the Bajoran militia is presented as a fighting force that would have successfully driven the Cardassians off the planet. There's something very soft and naive about the Bajoran militia. Their tactics, their inability to anticipate things. I don't know. How do you feel about the portrayal?
I definitely see what you're saying. And I think that that is seen specifically between Krim and Day. You know, Krim is somebody who does seem as though he is a legitimate military director,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas Day seems like somebody who may have gotten this position because they knew somebody.
Yeah.
And thinks they know what this means, but has really no idea. And so I think it actually kind of speaks to the danger of putting the wrong people.
Unqualified people in key positions.
Exactly. Yeah. That, you know, I think this is an incredibly important thing. You know, military organizations need people who are qualified. And there are many, many things that you can be disqualified from the military for. I mean, you know, you can be disqualified from the U.S. military for a vast number of things, right? And so I think that that's a thing that is good to remember. Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, that's where that's what this comes down to, is the juxtaposition between people who actually know what they're doing and people who think they know what they're doing, because mm-hmm. those are two totally different things.
Yeah. I think they know what they're doing is the key. Like, yeah. In the case of, well, Krim. Yeah, I agree. I think Krim is someone who actually is able to analyze situations, but when you analyze situations, you need to be given good information. And if you're not being given the information that you need, there's only so much that you can do.
Right. Well, and there's always a part of me that, you know, because you have that moment between him and Sisko in the second episode.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that he's always slightly wary of this entire situation in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just my feeling is, you know, that character. And then, like you said, he's missing important information because it's not delivered to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, again, we see that this person is not trustworthy and should not be mm-hmm. in this leadership position because they're not trustworthy. So, that to me is the place where I think that, and they utilize that. I mean, that is probably the only real story crutch that you get, but mm-hmm. it also makes sense because it fits in some ways with Jaro and what we see with him. That he is a opportunist who is utilizing this to get what he wants and doesn't really care about how he's getting it. And I think that Day is the same type of person, right? Mm-hmm. He's gotten power and that's really all he cares about, mm-hmm. but he hasn't earned it, truly. Yeah. So,
also, the way I read Day is that he's a person who has decided what is true. And it doesn't matter.
Exactly. 100%.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what information or what facts you give him. He's not going to listen. He has made up his mind of what reality is and what's true. And then it ends up being his undoing. And also, it's just incredibly naive. They go into a hollow suite. They know that they're going into a hollow suite. And he sees Sisko, Nalis there and just assumes it's really them. Like there's no caution whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then instantly, you know, it's the easiest trap. And that's another reason why I have a problem. I don't like the way the Bajoran militia is portrayed here because they shouldn't be able to be duped that easily. Or like Starfleet officer, you know, Bashir kicking in the panel down from the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And then that's okay. But then you've got like an officer popping up out of a yellow container. Like, how did you know it was time to pop out? It just, the portrayal, I think it could have been done a lot better and it would have made the, feel better.
I feel like that you're well within your rights to feel like that about that part of the episode. And, mm-hmm. and I think it does seem like that's one of the things about this episode is that they are more thinking about the full ramifications of the story for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're thinking a little bit less about all and maybe some of the intricacies of the plot mechanics to get there. And I do think if there is a weakness, that is probably the weakness here for this. But it doesn't bother me too much, you know.
Yeah, so. No, it doesn't bother me too much because the message of the episode is very strong.
Yeah,
And the other elements are well written and well portrayed. But I wish they had done a little bit more to make the cat and mouse game and the struggle on the station feel a little bit more real.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Last big topic to talk about is Lee Nalis, because he's what kicked off this whole story in the first place when they rescued him from the labor camp. He is, in a sense, he's the thread that runs through the whole story, but he's important to the story, but he's not so important, I think, that the story wouldn't work without him. And I think that becomes increasingly clearer as the three parts go on, as we progress towards the end. I've heard people say they feel like it. Even writers say they feel like he gets lost. I don't know if he truly gets lost because they pull him back at the end and he's important for resolving the story. And then they kill him. And the way he's killed, it almost feels like in the writing, they wanted to have this closure of a sacrifice. I think Ira has said this, like a sacrifice for Lee Nalis, like it had to mean something, but I don't feel like they built up to that moment very well. What do you feel like he gets lost in the story? What do you think about his fate and how he's killed off?
So I think one of the things that I really liked about his character in this episode was the moment in which he, you know, they're in the docking ring and, you know, he just lets the Bajorans there have it. You know, verbally.
I like that moment. Yeah, for sure.
And I think it's really strong.
Yeah.
And it legitimizes what it legitimizes is the belief in who this character could be if he allowed himself to be that person, right? He has what it takes to do that and to lead people, to do it well, just like everybody thought he did. And I think that moment really shows that. And yet at the same time, what I get from this character as we see him here in this episode and the conversations, you know, he has with Sisko, I think that the toil that he has been through has been so difficult that what he would want most is just to be left alone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's clear earlier in the trilogy that that's what he wants.
Right. But I think, the beauty of this moment, though, where he realizes that Sisko is being targeted and he doesn't even think, he just instinctively acts to put himself between, you know, Sisko and this beam, this phaser beam. I I think it really galvanizes just who this character is. And I think what it does is that it allows us to see that he was the person that everybody thought he was in the end. And yet at the same time, he also kind of gets what he wants, which is off the hook.
Yeah.
That's what he says at the end, actually.
Yeah, exactly. He says off the hook after all.
I don't think he was planning on it, right? At all. Right. But I also think it is probably one of those places where they utilize that to not have a hanging thread of a character that then they would feel like they would have to utilize at some point. And now, I will say it would have been interesting because this is a character that I could totally have seen being made, you know, Minister of Bajor or something along those lines, and being able to then have him in the show every once in a while. So they could have done that. But, you know, I don't have super strong feelings on it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I can totally see what you're saying, and I think it's valid. I like where the character, I guess, ends up. And then he gets his moment. And in some ways, he gets what he wants.
Yeah. No, I agree with what you're saying. I think that, so it makes me feel better about the sacrifice there. I feel like the scene for me maybe could have been presented a little bit better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think you're right.
What Ira Stephen Bear has said about it is that he felt that it was necessary to kill Linalis to complete his arc. Ira said that he felt like this was a man who was living a lie, and at the end there needed to be a form of redemption, one that involved some self-sacrifice. I don't know if that reading is really reflects how I see the character as much. Like, would you define Linalis as someone who is living a lie? Because I feel like that requires intent on his part to be living a lie, which I don't get from him so much.
No, I think the character feels as though he's continuously having to, in some ways, live a lie and be a person that he doesn't feel like he is.
To justify other people's views or exactly. to support other people's views. Right. He's intentionally trying to be.
But in that, the lie is one that is kind of, you know, it's eating away at him. He doesn't like it.
That's a good point.
And then therefore this gives him that moment to be able to, you know, go out the hero. And in some ways, yes, it allows him then to be the person that people thought he was, and to die that way and yet not have to continue to pretend anymore. And so I had a question for you because I think it connects with what we're talking about, because this is the first time that Star Trek had done a three-parter like this. And so with this being the first three-parter here in Star Trek, how does it work? Do you feel like this was a successful experiment that they did for, you know, Star Trek in general?
Well, definitely I do. I think it was critical to changing the style of storytelling for the series, because season one has a lot more serialization to it than we're accustomed to in Star Trek up to that point. But it doesn't fundamentally change the approach to storytelling in Star Trek, where I think this does. It doesn't instantly do it and then we never go back. By giving themselves room to breathe and tell this big, expansive story, they could test out how it works. They are able to add depth to characters and situations that they could not otherwise do. Mm-hmm. And I think that it allowed them to see, not just theoretically, but actually see it on screen and see how people reacted to it. They could see that this would work, and it allowed them to open things up. So I think it was highly successful, and I think it was key. And I sometimes wonder, if they hadn't done this, would the series have evolved into what it became, where it had this rich serialized story that interspersed standalone episodes, but just kept pulling us all the way to the end and made the series stand the test of time better than any of the other series.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good way to put it. And I think it does a very good job of, this is the place where, you know, we talked about all throughout the first season, is that Deep Space Nine was differentiating itself from TNG. And this is the place where that fully comes to fruition, in the sense of them saying, we are truly going to be a different type of show than TNG. And mm-hmm. we are going to completely embrace this idea of connectedness in our storytelling that you didn't get in that previous series. And we're not going to apologize for it. And we're not going to apologize for it by actually connecting episodes more so than you're used to, very specifically with this. Mm-hmm. But then just, I think that that then continues to be the type of storytelling that we get as we, you know, move forward. And so, no, I agree with you. I think it's incredibly successful. And I would say that kind of any of the story elements that we kind of were mentioning, some of those I think do come down to that this is the first time they've tried this on Star Trek in this way. And when you're trying to plot, you know, 3-part arcs, that it does take a different mindset, right? And mm-hmm. so they're flexing a new muscle. And so some of the that I think comes down to that. And obviously, I think we would both agree as we move forward, they get much better at this. Oh, so, yeah. You know, this is just the 1.0 version.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is the 0.8 version. It's still in beta.
There you go. There you go.
All right. Well, any final thoughts?
Just wait till
thoughts?
We get to the 7 of 9 version. So.
Oh, wow. any final thoughts? And what's your rating for The Siege? And well, final thoughts on both this episode and the trilogy, if there's anything else to say, and then rating yeah. for The Siege.
This is great. I love the way that this wraps up. You know, I think one of the things that was really poignant for me and really kind of touched me in watching the episode and found myself having certain emotions over was just that whole series of story points with the different family structures. And it's just so well done, you know, it feels, you know, Deep Space Nine feels like home. You know, mm-hmm. You have those shows that you can watch where you turn it on and it just feels like coming home, right? You know, and you can just kind of marinate in that show, and everything is comfortable and kind of cozy. And Deep Space Nine is that for me. It's one of those shows where I can do that. And I do think a part of that is because that's genuinely what the writers were trying to portray and to get across with all of these characters in the first place. This is their home and this is just their life. And we get a chance to be a part of that every week. And so it's a great episode. I would say it's a solid 4 out of 5 standing in front of a phaser beam. Yeah, it's really good. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, no, same. I think they wrapped it up well. I like the contrast with the middle part of the story where we focus on Kira and it's slower and we're down the planet. And then here we get a lot of action, but we do get a resolution to the overall story and what's going on. And it's like, I can't remember if I said this when we talked about the first part of the story or not, but the trilogy represents sort of like a hurdle to jump over for the series from the way they told stories up to that point to where they're going to go. And also not just that, but the mission, Sisko's mission, Starfleet's mission at Bajor. So there's this threat that arises where they're going to leave and the Cardassians are going to take over and everything would be a failure. But they get over that hurdle and then we can really accelerate from here and start exploring Bajor more. and Life on the Station were. So I feel like that works really well. One thing I did note is the ending. For everything that they went through to get the evidence and then actually take it and present the evidence, everything feels very quick there at the end. Jaro acquiesces very quickly. It reminded me of the end of The Undiscovered Country when they arrive at the Kittimer conference.
Yeah. And yes.
It's just like, hey, we're going to pull your mask off. And then everyone claps and we're done. It's like all this stuff went on. I think if I were going to make it more feel more realistic, I would want to have a little bit more than Kira just holding up the pad and announcing that she's got this evidence.
I think that's probably true.
But I mean, when she's doing it, I'm like, you need to protect this pad. They're just going to come yank it out of your hand and say, oh, we never saw any pad. Yes. What are you talking about? So, but again, you know, that's not the heart of the story or anything. And it's a pretty typical way to wrap something like that up. So it's fine. But no, I enjoyed this episode and the trilogy as a whole. I'm going to give The Siege 8 Odo tripwires.
Nice.
Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on The Siege as well. And of course, the whole Circle trilogy. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can leave your thoughts there for Matthew and me and fellow listeners. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not playing dress up with Kira and Dax, where can people find you?
Well, of course, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network outside of all the Star Trek talk on the 602 Club, talking about all of those franchises we love. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is called Owlpost with Drea Kaufman, as we talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and with Aggressive Negotiations, talking Star Wars with John Mills. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out how you're going to get that very large suitcase of latinum into your getaway ship, where can people find you?
What makes you think it's full of latinum? What are you talking about? I would never do anything like that. But no, when I'm not trying to smuggle latinum off the station, you can find me elsewhere on the network with you doing all those shows, as you mentioned, also many shows in the back catalog. And if you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek or anything else, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We wouldn't be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time. Now that the season opener is behind us, we can start performing some invasive procedures.
Well, that definitely sounds dangerous, but thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.